IAE Financial is an investment advisor representative with Symphony Financial, a registered investment advisor. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Symphony Financial. The topics discussed and opinions given are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. IAE Financial does not offer legal or tax advice. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their financial needs with the appropriate professional regarding your individual circumstance.
Listening to Checking In on Finance. Willing the good of a nettle.
Hey everybody, welcome to Checking In on Finance. We're going to do what we do every day, talk a little bit about what's happening in the markets. A couple of things that happened with a ballistic missile exercise, or would you call it an alert? And how would that have affected the markets over the weekend? Chuck and Anna Finance is brought to you by IAE Financial. IAE Financial, willing the good of another. Visit us online, IAEfinancial.com, or call the offices today, 832-953-4998. That's 832-953-4998. Annie, what's up?
How are you doing?
Any better, we'd be twins.
It is a beautiful day outside.
It's gorgeous. So, for those of you that are up north and have been dealing with the polar vortex, no, polar vortex was last year. That's so 1 year ago.
That's so old school.
This is the, cyclone bomb.
I would love to be the person who gets paid to make up these names.
Cyclone Bomb is, I got to tell you, there's very few names better than Cyclone Bomb.
I like it.
If I were a professional wrestler, that might be my name. But it was cold. It's cold. Every one of our plans in Houston, dead.
Well, the tropical ones anyway.
Yeah.
The ones slated for, zone five? The ones slated for zone five, dead.
Dead, because zone five doesn't typically get to 21 degrees.
No.
Now, we tried wrapping them. That didn't help. One iota.
4 days in a row of 21 degrees overnight they just can't sustain that.
Yeah, we don't get that in Houston, Texas very often.
No. All of our outside spigots are all wrapped
meanwhile, in I know that we
towels
have
and heat tape.
Meanwhile, we have listeners in Minnesota that are like, hold my beer.
And Boston.
Oh, yeah.
Where they had flooding and then it froze.
Yeah.
I mean, we had flooding in Houston that we talked about on the show, of course,
flooded,
our other show.
But frozen floodwater?
Frozen floodwater. Ugh. That is just devastating.
As my 3-year-old would say, that's terrible.
That's terrible.
That's terrible. So, something else interesting over the news. Some news over the weekend that kind of hit home, and we're actually looking at what happened. You know, we always want to see what's going to affect the markets and kind of what goes down. But there was an alert that went out to Hawaii. For those of you that are unaware, and I'm sure most of you have heard by now, but there was an alert that went out in Hawaii that said that there was an incoming missile, a missile threat. So for those of you that didn't hear about it, the missile threat that came out scared people absolutely to death, right? And really, it was a false alarm. But it took 38 minutes for it to go from a real, threat and scared. And that's 38 minutes of people losing their minds, right? I mean, we're not there. I'm sure that we have listeners that are there. And it's something, that can be scary. But the actual threat came out. And then 38 minutes later was the false alarm. Now, this was on a Saturday. And we're a financial show, so we're not going to get into the politics of it. We're not going to get into the defense none of that stuff. What I want to talk about is what would have happened to the markets if that occurred.
Buying opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, because think about what happens to the markets if that occurs while the markets are open.
I'm thinking major sell-off.
Huge sell-off. And I think it's a sell-off to the point where we could theoretically get what's called a lock limit down. And a lock limit down is when the market goes down so fast that it hits the circuit breakers and it locks the ability for the market to move. And then if you want to get out of a position, if you've got protective stop losses in place, if you're a short-term trader, those stop losses are going to get triggered once the market opens back up. And it may, because they close it for 15 minutes or so to kind of make sure that everything is working normal and everything's okay. And those lock limit downs hit. Lock limit downs, if they were to hit, that could cause a humongous transfer of wealth, because all the algorithms, because there's trading algorithms that chart the news, they're going to overreact to what was essentially a false alarm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, news of an emergency alert text message. And that's what it was people were getting, is that correct? People were getting text messages on their phone, emergency alert, ballistic missile, everyone go indoors.
And of course they ended it with, this is not a drill.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's, so it reminds me of a story that I heard once, and I'll tell you the story. It's actually not funny, but it's kind of funny when you relate it. So a friend of mine named Mark used to work when the New York Mercantile Exchange was in the bottom of the World Trade Center. So he worked at the World Trade Center, and he had the World Trade Center. If you think about the World Trade Center, what it was built on, right? Battery Park, that whole area, it's landfill.
Landfill, yeah.
Right? So when they dug the World Trade Center out and they put all that landfill in along the river, all the rats kind of came up from the river. So what most people didn't realize is that apparently the World Trade Center was littered with rats. Littered with rats. Rats were all over the place. And so Mark was telling me this story about it. And he was on the floor. And there was a clerk that he had named Irene. Okay? So, and Mark was telling me this story that when he was in his early 20s and he's on the trading floor, this rat came up and it attacked Irene. Yeah, this rat bit her and it made her hand bleed or whatever.
Really?
Yeah, a rat attacked Irene. So what somebody heard was a rat attacked Irene.
Oh, no.
And what they heard was Iraq attacked Iran.
Yeah.
And so gold went through the roof, And Mark and all the other traders were like, what do you mean a rat attacked Iran? Where did that come? And then all of a sudden it dawned on him all of a sudden, because the market went, gold went boom straight up because there was, Iraq attacked Iran. Oh my God. Instead of a rat attacked Irene. And they went and immediately shorted as much gold as they could because they knew that that's not real. That's not really what happened. But it was that news that came out that caused panic, right? Now, in this case, it caused panic buying because when things like that occur, there's a run to safety, and gold is the big safety net, right? But then they started shorting as it was running up because they knew that this is total crud, and they made a lot of money on the way down. They said that night they sent Irene to a steak dinner in a limo. Right?
Is that a true story?
That's 100% true story. 100% true story. His name is Mark. He's a guy that I worked with for a while in New York, and he's a hilarious dude. He was on in the movie Trading Places. He was one of the extras in Trading Places where they're on the floor, sell, buy. He was on the floor in that. But that's kind of what happened here, right? Mm-hmm. So the moral of the story is that we will sometimes see the market overreact on unconfirmed news, right? The market will sometimes overreact on unconfirmed news. Now, there's nothing anybody could have done about it today.
I think the market will overreact sometimes on confirmed news as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it'll react on confirmed news.
The market is driven by fear and greed.
Right.
Right. Not necessarily. Like, we talk about things being overvalued and, you know, earnings per share and fundamentals and stuff like that. But when it comes down to it, these shares from these companies are being traded on the secondary markets. So, once the shares are already out there, then the price is being controlled by supply and demand of
sure.
who wants the shares and fear and greed. So I think to a large extent, the market can react overreact on any kind of news,
whether it's
confirmed or unconfirmed.
It will, but the interesting thing is sometimes that news is already priced into the stock.
Yeah.
Right? Like look at the tax plan, right? The tax plan passed and we've continued to rally higher. Well, I think that everybody kind of knew the tax plan was going to pass. And so that's why we've had 100, I think the number right now is 109 consecutive days without a 1% drop.
Yeah.
109, I think that's what the number is right now. 109 consecutive days without a 1% drop is almost unheard of. It's almost unheard of. You're not going to get any more than that almost in the history of markets, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that is an absolute thing. So right now, the S&P at an all-time high. Everybody's happy. I mean, we closed the week at 2785. 2800 is, you know, right in the realm. 3000 is something that's becoming very, very realistic that people can see. Question is, when does it stop, right? We'll talk we'll probably talk a bit later about what is a melt up or a meltdown and markets look like over the long haul and over the big picture. I wrote an article this week for equities.com where I talked about that and it's the concept of this melt up, melt down, and everywhere in between. But really it's understanding, what do I do to protect myself? And if I know what to do to protect myself in any of these markets, that's where I'm going to have an advantage, and that's what I need to look for. So let's talk a bit about the news. And when we talk a bit about the news, we're going to shift gears here a little bit. Shifting gears. You see what I did there?
Yeah.
You see what I did there? Shifting gears. Brilliant. You guys will understand why here in a moment, because we like to talk about news, the news headlines that are moving the market this week. And we always start our news headline with the news of the weird, 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 weird. And today's news of the weird, I'm just going to read you the headline. Man rams armored vehicle into shop just for one bottle of wine.
He was tanked.
I'm going to throw this out there. I'm going to throw this out there. He has a problem. You think he has a problem? So a man, this was in Moscow. So that's the first part, right?
No. It's published by Moscow in Reuters.
Oh, no.
It did not happen in Moscow.
Oh, I read it wrong. Yeah. I thought it was in Moscow.
No, it happened in a town called Apatiti.
Yeah, I got nothing. But he drove a tank.
It's a small town just south of the Arctic Circle. Every sentence in this article makes me go, oh my God, I can't even believe it's real.
He drove a tank into the store because he wanted wine. Now, it was a family convenience store. Imagine having a family convenience store and somebody conveniently slamming a tank into the front door.
A whole tank. Like an army tank.
That's
when,
awesome.
When I read armored vehicle, it says armored personnel carrier.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, just for the record, I don't know where you buy one, but I want a freaking tank.
No, he stole it. Yeah. And then he swiped the vehicle from a privately run motorsport training ground nearby, drove it through a forest and into a small town just south of the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
Like every part of that sentence is like, what?
All
for a bottle of wine.
He's awesome.
Yeah. He opens the hatch, jumps out of the army tank.
Well, my bottle of wine. This is terrible.
Yes. And then what is equally hilarious is the article says the shop was not licensed to sell alcohol that early in the morning.
That's awesome. I don't think your license matters when you've got a tank in, tank cleanup on aisle 6. I mean, that's going to make it for a rough day.
Yeah. And I can't imagine that living just below the Arctic Circle is an easy life. And so the response to a lot of these people, the witnesses who saw this happen, the article says they didn't seem particularly disturbed by the incident.
Well, you know, because it just happens. I mean, when you live that far north, you just got to be okay with random stuff.
Yeah, I think so.
Now,
oh my gosh.
Here's the interesting thing. That shop owner, he's going to need to take out a loan. Which leads us to our next article about the big bank stocks. So, yeah. So an article on MarketWatch. An article on MarketWatch as we kind of watch these markets continue to run higher. Article on MarketWatch that I found really interesting. Now, this came out on January 11th, so it's a couple of days ago, but it says big bank stocks have plenty of juice left. And here's why. So he's talking specifically about big bank stocks. And then you compare this with investors.com. Investors.com has a couple of names that they had talked about, you know, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, PNC, a couple of different companies that they specifically talked about. But, you know, what he's talking about is that the new Federal Reserve Chief Jerome Powell will likely be inclined toward less regulation, which is a big reason to favor financials in 2018.
Yeah, I'm sure they're popping Dom Perignon.
Yeah. Pop the Dom.
Yeah.
Pop the Dom. No, I mean, when you think about it, if you've got, first of all, the tax cuts are going to be a big thing, right? Mm-hmm. The tax cuts are going to help a lot. The Trump administration, you know, hands out reprieves to banks. And that's not, I'm not saying that's bad. I'm not saying that's good. But what I'm saying is that it will definitely have an effect on the underlying performance of these banks.
Mm-hmm. But if you look at, like they put up a chart of, XLF, which is the ETF for the financial sector.
Right.
And you can see that we are approaching the peak right before the financial collapse of 07-08.
Yeah,
right?
which I find interesting because just about every other sector is higher than it was in 08. Actually, every other sector is higher than it was in 08 except financials, because financials just took such a humongous hit back in 08.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think it's, you know, if they do go up, I'm not sure that that as an investor, I would be comfortable getting in right below the previous top prior to the, you know, the credit default swap crash.
Yeah, you might want to wait for some sort of a little bit of a breakout. A little bit of a breakout for price to kind of break through that ceiling. But there's a lot of names in financials that people are very excited about. And part of the reason comes from, there were financial companies at the CES, the Consumer Electronics Show this week, where they were highlighting some of their new technology, some of their smart technology. And a lot of these companies, you know, Jamie Dimon came out. He had come out and blasted Bitcoin a couple of months ago, and he came out this week and said, yeah, I was wrong. Bitcoin's great.
But by the same token, there's South Korea just announced information that they may completely outlaw trading of Bitcoin. And so it did take a little bit of a hit. And I think that's one of the risks in trading something like that, because the United States hasn't announced any regulation on it. And different countries are starting to look to see, you know, how they're going to regulate it and if they're going to regulate it. And so there is a bit of you know, still of risk there.
I think there's more than a bit of risk there. There's a lot of risk there. And that, I think, you know, when you look at any investment, if you can't find the risk, right? If you look at any investment and you can't find the risk, run, right? There's no such thing as an investment that has no risk. And if you look at an investment and it's too good to be true, that's because it is. And I think Bitcoin falls right into that, because you're right. There's a tremendous amount. And I believe that the biggest risk that Bitcoin faces is regulatory risk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and here's another thing about Bitcoin. Bitcoin is supposed to be what? Bitcoin is supposed to be a currency.
Currency.
Right? Bitcoin's a currency. So when you think of a currency, when you go to Japan, what do you buy with? You buy and sell with?
Yen.
It's a currency, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you go to Europe, what do you buy and sell with?
Euros,
because it's a currency. So Bitcoin is a currency, right? You buy and sell things with Bitcoin. That's the idea anyway. Bitcoin has a conference this week in Miami. But you need cash because you can't buy tickets with Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. It's a currency that you cannot use. So it's really just a trading vehicle. That's all it is. It's lost its true, you know, concept of it as being a currency where you can buy and sell things. And there are still some people buying and selling things using Bitcoin. But for the most part, it's just a trading vehicle. And since the futures market was launched, now I want to go, when I talk about the futures market that was launched, it was launched in December. It was the Bitcoin futures was launched at $20,650, so $20,000. As of the close of business on Friday, it was trading at $13,775. So that's about a 35% decline in the futures markets for Bitcoin in the, you know, 20 days that it's been trading.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not boding a lot of confidence with investors. And I think a large part of that movement is because the fundamentals do kind of scare people. Now, as the banks get more involved with this, and this kind of ties it back to that big bank stocks, as the banks get more involved and there becomes more legitimacy behind it, that's when it takes off. I've said from the beginning, I think Bitcoin's a tremendous opportunity. I really do. I believe that it's a great opportunity. I just don't know that it's a great opportunity yet. I've wanted to see Bitcoin come smashing down. And then as more things, you know, it becomes a more applicable product, then people will start to use it, right? As it stands now, you hear people talking about Bitcoin, but who's the first person you've heard using a Bitcoin? I've never met one. Maybe I live a sheltered life. Let me know. Send us a tweet, right? Shoot us a tweet at IIE Financial. Let us know if you've ever heard of somebody actually using a Bitcoin. I've heard of people trading Bitcoins, but I've not really heard of them using the Bitcoins.
So yesterday I went and I got my hair cut. And I go to the same lady. She's in her 50s.
Must be nice. Don't rub it in. Must be nice to have hair that you can get cut.
And she was asking me about investment advice. She's interested in learning more about investments and what she can do with her money. And her husband is self-employed and they're interested in trying to figure out what they're going to do. And the very next words out of her mouth were, "What do you think about Bitcoin?"
Yeah.
So I think it goes back to that hair, like, what's the quote about, like, the shoeshine boy?
Well, first of all, the shoeshine boy was underdog. There's no need to fear, underdog is here.
No.
It was Joe Kennedy who said, when your shoeshine boy is giving you stock advice, it's time to get out of the market.
Okay. So when your hairdresser starts asking you about Bitcoin,
it's time to get out of Bitcoin. Yeah. No, so. And there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, it's... But I do like the concept of the financials here. I think that there's some upside in financials, especially if they start to embrace some of this technology. If they start to embrace some of this technology and find a way to use it, then mm-hmm. we're going to start to see some major, major shifts in the technology sector. And sectors are an important part, right? So when we talk about different sectors and understanding what a sector is, then we can start to see how they roll together, because all these things tie together. And if you know what all of these things mean, that once again gives you a little bit of a leg up. Let's talk a bit about sectors today, because I think it's good to really look at the sectors of the financial markets and see which ones are hot, which ones are not, and understand the concept of sector rotation. And I think that if we step back and look at sector rotation, it can be a pretty good, I don't want to call it a predictor, but it can be a pretty good indication of where markets may move in the future.
Yeah, so we have a smattering of lots of different experience listening to the show. So investing experience. So some people may be a very common term for them, sector rotation, but you know, someone like my hairdresser is just getting into this. So can you explain what a sector is?
Yeah, I think it's good to understand what a sector is and really which sectors are going to be good at different times. So knowing which sectors will be good at different times is going to be something that's important. So first of all, think of a sector as taking the whole stock market and breaking it down into pieces, right? So here's an analogy, and I like this analogy. This analogy works well for me. I'm a sports fan, right? Could I break sports down into multiple types of sports?
Yes.
Yeah. Football, baseball, basketball, hockey. Now, I'm a football fan. Could I take football and break it down into multiple types of football?
Sure.
College football, high school football, professional football. And then let's take professional football. Could I break that down into different teams?
Of course.
Right? So let's pretend for just a moment that I don't like sports at all, meaning I'm bearish on sports. What's the probability that I'm going to like a team?
Zero.
Slim to none, right? Like yeah. Maybe I'll like him because my cousin plays on the team or something, right? Yeah. Like here's a good example. Our brother-in-law, his cousin, I think at one point played for the Astros. He doesn't really like sports, but he liked the Astros while his cousin was on the team. Mm-hmm. So there are those rare exceptions, right? Where maybe you're bearish on sports, but you like a particular team. Conversely, continuing, let's say I like sports, but I don't like football. What are the chances I'm going to like the Dallas Cowboys?
Very little.
Very little. But then again, who likes the Dallas Cowboys anyway? I'm just kidding, Cowboy fans. No, I'm not. but if I like sports and I like football and I like professional football, is there a chance I'll like the Cowboys?
It would be higher.
It's a higher probability, right? So the reason I say that is because think about the stock market as broken down into sectors. The market is broken down into sectors. Each sector is then broken down into what's called industry groups. Those industry groups are then broken down into individual stocks. So you have the S&P 500, which is the whole stock market. It's broken down into sectors. And our sectors, the most common sectors, are things like financials, technology, energy, healthcare, energy, utilities, consumer discretionary, consumer staples. Those are really, really wide, big things, right? So let's take technology. Technology can then be broken down again into industry groups. Semiconductors, hardware, software, cloud-based systems. Those are all different technology industry groups inside of the sector. Now, let's take those industry groups and they're made up of individual companies, right? Like NVIDIA is, semiconductors underneath the technology sector, which is in the whole market. So think about it. If the whole market's going down, is it going to be easy for me to find a stock that's going up?
Probably not.
Probably not. Because it's easier to go with that market, right? Well, inside the market, there are going to be sectors that are top performing and underperforming. And there's this concept called the sector rotation model. If you want to Google it, you can go find it anywhere. It's a really simple chart to look at. But what it shows is that certain sectors are more popular than others depending on what the overall market is doing. So when we are in a very strong bullish market, the market's going up, people are a little bit more inclined to risk. They're willing to put more risk capital out there. Well, that's when consumer discretionary, also known as cyclicals, and technology are super valuable. People love them. People love those. And then as those start to get a little overcooked, if you will, because everybody's invested in them, then money maybe starts to flow into sectors like financials and basic materials and industrials. And then as those start to get overcooked, now people start to flow into energy. And now that's when our ears should perk up. When energy is the top performing sector, that's typically what then leads to, you know, the market is capped out and now we start to come down, right? So as we come down, the sectors that people like the most are what we call the flight to safety. Right? The flight to safety.
Those are called defense stocks, right?
Yeah, defense stocks. So what do you think a flight to safety is going to be, right? Everybody that's at home, think about your own, you know, when the market starts to go down, do you turn off your lights?
Or do you buy less milk?
Right.
Or less food? Like food is like a defense type.
You don't buy less food. You don't buy less water. You don't smoke less. So believe it or not, alcohol stocks, tobacco stocks
are actually part of the defense.
Are part of the defense industry.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I think people tend to drink and smoke more when the market goes down.
We say defense, that's like an actual technical term. We're not talking about like military defense or anything like that. These are called defense stocks because they are defensive in a down market. They may decline a little bit, but typically not very much. People fly to those because they will be more stable because, like we said, if the market's not going down, you still have to feed your kids.
Yeah. And that's really what it comes down to. And utilities as well, because they pay typically a decent dividend yield.
Right.
So what I want to look at is where are we on that sector rotation model, right? Well, what has been the top performing sector for the last 18 months? It's been technology. Everybody knows that. Technology has been through the roof. Everybody talks about, the FANG stocks. But now, what's starting to get everybody's attention? Well, we talked a little bit about financials in the in our last segment together. And what about oil? What's happening with the price of oil?
Right. Well, it's gone up a little bit, and we
price of oil's gone up, and what's that going to do to the price of oil stocks? Right, price of oil stocks. Think about it. If they were making money pulling oil out of the ground at $45 a barrel, at $50 a barrel, are they making more money when they're pulling it out of the ground at $65 a barrel? Mm-hmm. See, think about it. We've gone from $45 a barrel to $65 a barrel in the last 2 months. have these companies hired $20 a barrel more worth of people? Probably not. So have their expenses gone way, way, way up? No. Has their income gone up? Yes. Now, so these energy stocks could be a sector that's going to gain some favor. So too would be industrial stocks. And if you look at industrial stocks, because industrial stocks, they benefit from that higher cost of materials, as they are the ones that are providing those materials, right? Companies that are providing materials that are going to benefit from them, they're going to do very well as that price of oil starts to seep up. So what we're looking at now is this concept of we're starting to see the rotation, not out of the technology sector, because you know there's still plenty of room to run, but we could theoretically see the next sector that really takes over being basic materials and industrials, and then leading into energy. And those occur typically around market tops. Historically, those occur around market tops. Whereas over the last 2 years, last 7 years, technology and consumer discretionary have been really, really strong, high-performing stocks. We may see a little bit of weakness in those sectors going forward.
Yeah, and if we're looking into an ideological crystal ball, we just had the tax plan pass, which will hopefully stimulate the economy. It's meant to, you know, stimulate the economy. And if you have that market top of, you know, an increase in the energy sector, and the staple sector and basic materials, that is coincident with an early recovery and a pickup of the actual economy itself.
And the economy picking up, you know, the economy is gonna lag the market in general, right? So the lagging of the market in general by the economy is something that's pretty important that we need to pay attention to. And by pay attention, I don't mean that, you know, we need to watch the news media every day and kind of see what happens, but you know, just paying attention to the big things, right? Like GDPs and things like that, because the market will always lead the economy, always, because it's just going to move faster. But just, you know, because you'll still see the economy growing. You'll see the economy continuing to grow after the market begins its rollover. Mm-hmm. And that's where the head fake comes in, because a lot of investors, they're too late to get out, because they say, well, why would I get out? GDP is continuing to go up and jobless numbers are good, but the market begins its downturn before the economy falls. And all that's built into sector rotation.
Yeah. And I think that just has to do with the fact that we have such access to getting in and getting out in the market. Right? It can happen with literally like the click of a button. And so obviously it's going to react way faster than the overall economy will.
Yeah, it's money, I think, moves now faster than it ever has. And the sheer volume of money that's coming in and out of the markets, I think, completely blows people away. And speaking of volume, there's a lot to be said for what's happening in volume. So, you know, when we understand how these sectors move, it's going to help us to really figure out what the right plan is for our investing future and for what our long-term goals and growth are going to be. Long-term planning is important. And so, you know, it's funny. I always like to kind of go back to articles when we talk about long-term planning. One of the most important things for long-term planning is that it starts early, right? You should start planning early. And we got a three-year-old and a five-year-old. They're in the other room playing Nintendo. But we got a three-year-old and a five-year-old. And what is it that they're going to do when they go to college, right? What's it going to look like? What are things going to do? How are things going to change? And I think a lot of parents out there and grandparents that are trying to save for their kids' education, an interesting article came up on MarketWatch that says, here's what U.S. colleges will look like in 2030. And you've got kind of a unique perspective on this.
Yeah, I'm teaching a personal finance class to a group of high school students.
Okay.
And this,
which, by the way, that's sorely lacking in high schools.
Absolutely. It really is. These kids are coming in. I have a smattering of kids from 15 to 18. So some are just coming into high school, and some within 4 months are going to be on their own. And the lack of experience that they have with just their own personal money, never mind investing or saving or
right.
what is a bank. Like, they are in general clueless, right? I'm teaching them from a clean slate pretty much, which is alarming in a lot of respects. And I think it's interesting that this article talks about how many American colleges will have to look different. It says decades from now if they're going to survive. And the article is talking about how demographics are shifting around schools. And so the schools are going to have to choose, are going to have a very different selection pool of candidates, specifically in the Northeast, because the trend of migration right now is south. I mean, look at us. We moved north to south, you know, coming up on 5 years ago. And so it says that schools that don't think creatively about how to adapt to these changes could be forced to merge or shut down. And so mostly this is talking about the shift from majority white to majority minority in Northeastern population centers to the Southwest. And it's saying that the selection pool, like a Northeastern school is not going to have the same recruiting rates from looking at kids in the Southwest. Like,
yeah, well, kids, Southwest, kids from Texas ain't going to Rhode Island.
And that's what their point is. So they're losing a lot of their selection pool to the South. And if they don't get their act together, they're either going to have to merge or they're going to go out of business. And so this article is coming at it from a demographic standpoint at the beginning, and then it goes on to how two-year colleges and are pulling candidates, and so they're not getting that full 4 or even 5 years of tuition, because I think about 15 years ago, it right. was pretty well established that these colleges had made it so that it would take you 5 years to graduate.
Oh yeah, I mean that's a plan.
Yeah, that no was doubt. Yeah, for the extra tuition. And I think
you want to take your time and enjoy the college experience. Yeah, and they increase their revenue by 20%.
Absolutely. And
anybody who, and I get off on a tangent because I think higher education is such a business that it sickens me. But anyway.
Yeah, and they increased the amount of time, thus increasing their revenue. And I think kind of like when, you know, we've talked about oil before, and this has nothing to do with it, but at the same time, you know, the oil companies had raised prices so much that at $5, consumers were like, you know what, I'm going to go buy a smart car.
Right.
You know, so, and I think that to a large extent, this is happening with education. Tuition is so astronomical, and you, for a large percentage of students going to school, they're not getting jobs to be able to pay off that tuition. Like, how many jobs can you possibly make for a business degree?
Right.
You know, you're pumping out kids with $150,000 worth of debt with a business degree.
Sure.
You know?
And what are you going to do with
that? What are you going to do with that? You know? Not that it's, you know, okay, I'm not saying that no one should get a business degree, but what I am saying is if you pump out hundreds of thousands of kids with business degrees, there just aren't that many jobs to fill them all. Okay, and so I think people are starting to realize that, and parents don't want to spend the money in that tuition to, you know, for 4 or even 5 years of worth of tuition to get a business degree, and then they're saddled with the debt, or the student saddled with that debt. And so there is the rise of the two-year college.
Right.
Right. So a lot of people are starting to send their kids for the basics to the local community college for your English, your math, your, you know, all of your,
sure.
your core classes.
Like in Texas, we have Lone Star, right?
Yeah. Locally we have Lone Star. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of kids are going to high school and getting dual credits for their high school graduation and also for their community college credits. And they're able to graduate with, I have one student in my class now, he will graduate high school with also 30 credits of college.
So he's trimmed He's trimmed a full year and a half. No, almost a full year.
Well, actually, if you're looking at the five
a semester,
if you're looking at the 5-year plan that colleges are kind of forcing students into, you're looking at 2 years,
right?
Because they only one year, right? Because they only want you to really take 12 to 15 credits per semester. So you're looking at like a whole year, you know, that this kid has taken off before he even graduates high school. And so I think looking forward, one of the things that I'm teaching the kids in my personal class is maybe you're not called to a 4-year degree.
Right.
There's vocational schools and trade schools, which I think get a bad rap.
They get a very bad rap.
You know, but I know a lot of boilermakers who are making $200,000, $250,000 a year, and they have a very specific skill set,
right?
You know, that is actually needed in the United States. So, you know, everybody wants to send their kids to a really good, you know, 4-year college, and you need to go to college, and the pressure on these kids to go to college, and the pressure on the parents, because, you know, in the coffee klatch circles, where's your kid applying to? Where's your kid going to school? You know, and everybody is funneled into these, you have to go to a 4-year degree, you know, kind of thing. I don't think is the path for the future, not to mention the rise of the online degree, right? So,
well, and here's what I look at, and I just kind of pulled it up as we're talking. I went to a small region, one of these regional universities you're talking about. I went to a small regional university in Pennsylvania, California University of Pennsylvania. Yes, that exists, people. There's California, Pennsylvania. Anyway, don't worry about it. When I was there, I think that the tuition was something like $3,500 a year or something like that. And for me, that was a lot. And I'm 40 years old. I'm pushing 40. So it was almost 20 years ago. It's now $20,000 a year to go even to a state school in Pennsylvania. Now, we're not talking Penn State. We're talking a state school in Pennsylvania that and that's an average student of 12 credits. This is right on their website. It says the average cost to attend CalU for an undergraduate student enrolled in 12 credits is $20,826. That means that this student gets out with $100,000 of student loan debt at a 5-year degree at this rate. So if you've got $100,000 hanging over your head, and that's why a lot of people want to pay for their child's education up front. But there's got to be some sort of a plan to do that.
Yeah, and I think you need to know why you're going. If you just think that you're saving for your kid to just pump them through college, I don't think that's a good plan. If you're going, like, I went for a very specific thing. I went for mechanical engineering.
Right.
If you're going to a 4-year degree for engineering, yes, you need to go to a school for something that specific. If you're going for English,
yeah,
you can do that a lot cheaper in an online program, right? There are so many more. And I think the point is that plan needs to assess all of the different options.
And when we talk about the plan, what we need to do is bring it back and talk about the plan to pay for it ahead of time.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we got two boys that are six and going to be four. And I keep saying five and three, but the six and going to be four. We got to know ahead of time how much is that going to be, and how do we plan effectively for that? And I talked to a parent the other day that, you know, they've got two girls that are, I think he said that his girls were one and four. And he said, that's something I need to concern myself with, is what's my financial plan for them, and how am I going to pay for them going forward and in the future?
Mm-hmm. And what if they want to start their own business?
Right. Who says you absolutely have to go to college? And who knows? Being here in Houston, everybody just seems to want to eventually go work for an oil company anyway. We live here in Houston, so, you know, we got to look at oil. We got to talk about what the energy markets are doing and what the energy prices have done, because that's kind of where our wheelhouse is of all the people we know. Most of the people we know in some way, shape, or fashion are somehow employed with or by the oil industry or the oil service industry or something like that. And so we've talked on this show for a while about you know, kind of where oil is and where we're looking at. And when I look at the price of oil, and I primarily look first at the crude oil futures, and I'm looking at the February contracts, it closed off at $64.40 a barrel on the February contracts on the light sweet crude. And so continuing that run up, and I've been marching this drum for a while that I think there's room for oil to go to 80, and I don't think that's going to change.
Yeah, when we first started doing this segment, when we were asked to do this segment, what was it? I don't know, 6 weeks ago?
Or something like that.
Something like that, 2 months ago or something like that. What was it, like $45, $50?
Yeah, $48 a barrel at that time.
And you had said that it had room to, you know, it had room to run, and that's what it's done.
The key was getting through that $55 barrel. That barrier of 55 had been what was stopping us for the longest time. And now 55, it's in the dust, right? As oil has just continued to march higher. And when we look at the supply and demand equation, right, when we look at the supply and demand equation, demand greatly exceeds supply right now when it comes to kind of these futures markets. And, you know, oil just continued to rise.
Yeah. And there in this, I'm looking at an article on investing.com, and it talked about how analysts and traders had warned about the risk of a price correction since the start of 2018. So, you know, be careful for a pullback. But then we keep seeing OPEC and overseas drillers reducing output.
Yeah, so
there's going to drive price up.
Well, yeah, I mean there's an OPEC led deal to reduce production, and you know, I find that to be the most interesting thing in the world. Hey, we're not making enough money, so let's reduce production. It's completely manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally manipulated. It has really almost very little to do with the demand and the supply when you're the one controlling the supply. And the OPEC, when you think about the OPEC does, that really controls the overall supply, which determines the price.
Yeah. And it's so much so that, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, minuscule barrels here. We're talking about like 80 million barrels of oil, you know, that in the week, you know, in a week.
I mean, you know, they said we see that market surplus is decreasing, but the market is not completely balanced. So markets remain buoyed on comments that we've got, you know, huge room to run, if you will. And I believe that, and I'm just looking at it from a technical perspective, from what the technicals tell us by understanding how to read charts and understanding how demand and supply works, there's room for oil to run to 80. And I'm talking the light sweet crude, and light sweet crude got as high as 64.77. If you look at Brent crude, it got over 70. It got over $70 a barrel.
I mean, yeah. And I think that there's a marriage, a relationship, if you will, between, you know, the technicals and the manipulation, I guess we can call it, you know, of the oil companies, because though they're controlling the supply, you know, I've said before, when oil did get so high and as a result, you know, drove up gas prices and things like that, the consumers reacted. And so there was a reaction to the manipulated supply. And so what we see in the charts is a reflection of that reaction, in terms of the supply and demand and these fair price levels, as you call it, as we call them on the charts. And so that's why we're seeing, the next fair price area up around 80. And, you know, you've said we have room to run, because that's where consumers sort of balked. You know, and you had that fair price area marked in on, illuminated on the chart. Like we're just not taking it anymore, kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's it. That's where it's kind of like the old commercial from the 80s. I will not pay a lot for this muffler, right? I think Midas had that commercial.
Wow, yeah.
At some level, they draw the line. Now, I will say that though oil is currently at around $64 a barrel, and I'm looking at the February oil futures contract, and I always look at the contracts, right? Because as investors, as mom and pop investors, as people that are sitting listening to this at home, if they want to profit from oil, they typically are going to go buy ExxonMobil, or they're going to buy Chevron or Royal Dutch Shell, or, you know, an oil company stock. They're not going out buying some light sweet crude. But you could look at the futures markets, and I use the futures markets as my gauge. And there are ETFs of the oil market that could be used as well. And so I've got a number of clients, that's kind of what they look at. But when I look at crude oil, so right now we're primarily trading the February contract. It's trading at $64 a barrel. But if I go out, interestingly enough, to the December contract of next year, so I go out and I look at the December contract, meaning it's going to expire in December. So longer term, right?
Of 2018?
Of 2018.
Okay.
That's trading at almost $61 a barrel. So it's actually trading at $3 a barrel lower than the more front month contract. So what that tells us...
Does volume come into play at all when you're looking at that kind of thing?
There's a little bit less volume. There's definitely less volume in the December than there are in the front month.
Sure.
No question. But what that tells us is that they're pricing in the markets to fall between now and then. Now, interestingly enough, though, if I look at the June contract, so if I go looking at the June contract instead of the December, the June contract has oil trading at $64 a barrel again.
Meaning, even though that's one of the travel months and stuff,
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't we get historically like a pop?
Historically,
in this?
We'll get a little pop from there, but we have to look at... That what I see from looking at that, right? Because you can do what's called a spread. You can buy one and sell the other. That's what a lot of people will do in these futures markets. And we're certainly not talking about spreads on this show. It's a little bit deeper than what we need to go. But what we can look at there is that the longer term contracts are actually trading lower, right? Which tells us that we may get a little bit of an intermediate term pullback after it continues that run up. Mm-hmm. That's what I see when I look at something like that.
Okay.
Sometimes you'll see oil that's higher on those further out contracts, but here we're seeing it a bit lower.
Okay. And what's volume been like on, you know, well, like we always try to look at, you know, volume with the prices.
Yeah. And volume is still fairly high. It's still fairly high relative to where it's been in the past. So there's no real strong.
So we have increasing price on high volume.
Yeah. Increasing price on high volume. And that's really what you want to see. Now, interestingly enough, another article on investing.com says natural gas futures soar after largest storage withdrawal on record. So natural gas futures surged last week on Thursday, hitting their highest levels in a week after data showed the largest withdrawal on record in U.S. supplies. Now, why do you think we would have such a large withdrawal? Well, it was cold.
Yeah. This article was...
It was hilarious. I love this article.
Oh my gosh. Where was that point in the article that... Let's see. Bullish speculators are betting that cool weather will increase demand for heating fuel. Really?
Really?
It's winter. We just had a cyclone bomb.
You don't get, you don't get a medal for that, right? you don't get a medal for that, Sherlock. You don't need to figure that one out. Of course, you're going to increase demand of heating oil in the winter.
When there's a cyclone bomb and Texas is experiencing the coldest winter ever.
Yeah, and then they end the article with the heating season from November through March is peak demand for the U.S. gas consumption. Really?
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 I'm glad that someone
glad somebody
got paid
pointed
to write
that out
that
to me. Somebody got paid to point that out to me.
Right,
that's awful nice of you.
Hang your investing hat on that article.
Oh, it's cold.
It's
time
cold.
To buy oil. No, but the thing to remember is, you know, the fact that we've pulled back oil, the fact that we've run up in oil and run up in natural gas is not a coincidence, right? They're not a coincidence. They're tied to one another. And the fact that they're tied to one another really is why that happens. And if we see natural gas continue to go up in price, you know, there's a chance that you'll start to see a little bit more output coming from some of those wells where they've kind of maybe shut off the tap a little bit. Right, there's a number of wells in the Marcellus Shale and in some of the other drawing places where they've just kind of closed off the tap, and that's they're just not interested in pulling from
those.
Yeah,
we see that when we go back to visit your family up in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, my family's in Pittsburgh.
I mean, there's so many
abandoned wells.
Yeah, well, not abandoned, I guess, but they're not abandoned really, right?
They're dormant.
They're dormant,
yeah,
right?
They're dormant. They're just,
you know, there was a period there over the last maybe 5 years where drilling, you know, they cleared the landscape and there's wells everywhere just dotted throughout Western Pennsylvania. And now they're just kind of like sitting there.
Yeah. So sometimes those kind of things are a clue to what's happening. And by the way, those started to shut off before the price fell. Mm-hmm. So if you understood that and you start to look for what are the tea leaves telling me? Okay, so the moral of the story is this, and we're going to wrap this thing up. The moral of the story is this. If you have an idea of what you do in your everyday life and what the tea leaves are telling you, right, pay attention to what's going on around you, because those kind of things are what may eventually show up in the price of the underlying security. Mm-hmm. All right, we're out. Have a great day, everybody.
All right. IIE Financial is an investment advisor representative with Symphony Financial, a registered investment advisor. Charles Fulkerson is an investment advisor representative with IIE Financial and Symphony Financial, LTD Co. Annie Fulkerson is not registered nor affiliated with Symphony Financial. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Symphony Financial. The topics discussed and opinions given are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. IIE Financial does not offer legal or tax advice. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their financial needs with the appropriate professional regarding your individual circumstance.